Okay, I want today to talk about collaboration, but above all, resistance in Europe during World War II. And I'll talk mostly about France because that's where there's been so much written about. And also because France coming to grips with the Vichy past was not an evident thing. It was something that took a long time. There was a process of collective and official repression about what had happened. And so I want to talk about that because it's, again, I mean, histories have their histories. And that's, I've been around here long enough that I can remember all this happening, not the war, obviously, but France coming to grips with its past. So I want to talk about that. We haven't talked about France in a long time. I want to talk about that. But first, let me just say a couple things. Other countries had their resistors as well. It was obviously the most successful case of resistance was that of Yugoslavia, or ex-Yugoslavia. Because, you know, well before the end of the war, Marshal Tito, and his partisans taking advantage of the mountains of ex-Yugoslavia were able to pin down entire German divisions and with weapons parachuted in by the Allies and with entire, you know, moving hospitals, were able to launch the most effective resistance, arguably, in Europe. And of course, I mean, the case of the Soviet Union, you know, 25 million people died. 25 million people died in World War II, most of them in the war. But lots also in Stalin's camps. But a lot of partisans lost their lives picking off German soldiers. In the case of Poland, and it's in the third edition, there'll be more on this. They got scarcely a mention. The Polish had a home army, as they called it, of about 300,000 people by the end of the war, and the Warsaw Ghetto. Rose up and was crushed with 12,000 deaths and with thousands of other people sent away to the camps in 1943. And then the Warsaw Uprising, one of the reasons that the Warsaw where I'll be on Friday and go fairly often, was just there was nothing left because the uprising was crushed and thousands of people lost their lives. I just reviewed a book actually for the Boston Globe about called Ghetto Stadt, which is an interesting book by a man called Gordon Horowitz, who teaches in Illinois. And it's about the Lodz, L-O-D-Z ghetto. And it's, it's a tragic, all too familiar tale. It doesn't have anything to do with resistance because it was impossible. But it was about the German ideas of creating this Aryan city in Łódź, which was a big industrial town and still is in Poland. And of course, what they did is they put all the Jews into the ghetto, which was several kilometers square, and then put them to work making uniforms and earmuffs and all sorts of things for the German troops. And the story, really, the most horrific aspect of it is that the people in the ghetto, they don't really know. There's all these rumors about what's happening outside. And of course, what's happening is the killing fields. 3 million Jews, disappear in Poland in World War II. 3 million. Gradually, and some people before they're being killed by the Nazis are forced to write postcards, cheery postcards, saying all is well here in these camps. Everything is just delightful. And of course, then they're executed. But gradually, it's about the mounting horror of the people who live there, is that they see clothes stacked up outside the ghetto that they could recognize as having been on people they knew, who had been shipped away to the camps. And it's really just the whole thing is so horrendous, and it lives with us today. That obviously it was easier to resist in places in which you could hide. And when I talk about France, the reason, and I sent this term around, you call the French resistors the maquisards, or even just les maquis, is because they were able to hide behind brush called maquis, which more about this later. So resistance in Belgium, which is in the flat country outside of around the Argonne, was very, very difficult. In there's hardly a hill that's more than a hump in Denmark, but yet it was the Danes in Copenhagen who saved the Jews, who got them out with the help of a German officer and was able to get them just across the very narrow straits to Malmö in Sweden. And other countries had their resistances as well, and all of those can't be covered now in the short amount of time. Well, I'm not supposed to have this glass here, actually, because it has a label on it. I'm not supposed to have this glass here at all. But so I guess what I'll do is I want to talk about France and about the resistance there. Now, until about 1969, a year that I can remember, Altamont, the Mets win the series, but more important, protests against the war in the United States and mounting dissatisfaction with United States foreign policy. I mean, I can remember that very, very well. But until 1969, there in France, the official line was virtually everybody resisted. A few elites, a few notables, rural elites, collaborated, period. And the official line was one, of course, that was very closely tied to Gaullism. Because Charles de Gaulle, the big guy, his voice crackles over June 18th, 1940, and he calls on France to resist. And part of the myth that everybody resisted, or almost everybody and few people collaborated, had to do with the official Gaullist policy, which is that Gaullists resisted, and they were, that Charles de Gaulle, the sort of mystical, body of Charles de Gaulle, the body being greater than the sum of all its parts, led France, which essentially liberated itself. And of course, that's simply not true. And that also, what that forgot about was the fact that the communists were enormously important in the resistance, and more about that in a while. There was a film made, a documentary, I think in about 1953. I've never actually seen it. And it had to do with the Jews. It had to do with what happened to the Jews in France. And it was conveniently forgotten that the Jews in Paris who were arrested in the Marais, in the Jewish section of Paris and in other places too, were arrested by the French police. The Germans would have been happy to do it, but they didn't need to, because the French police were so eager to do that. And in this film, there was a Jews and other people, and communists and other people who were sent away, were packed off to a place called Drancy, which is, if you've ever taken the RER in from the airport, or to the airport, to Wassy Airport in Paris, you've gone through Drancy, and that was a transit camp. And in transit camps, rather like Malines or Mechelen in Belgium, or Westerbork, I guess it's called in the Netherlands, quite near the German border, these camps were run by French, Belgians, and Dutch. They were not run by the Nazis. The Nazis would have been happy to do it, but the local populations, the local collaborators were doing that. And in this film made in 1953, in the original, there's, you can see a French gendarme who's guarding the Jews at Drancy. Now, in the documentary that was finally released, somebody has reached in and plucked him from the film, and he simply disappears. It's doctored. So the French gendarme with his French gendarme hat isn't in the film. Because the myth was, of course, that the Jews were taken away and by the Germans, and that communist resistors were shot by the Germans, and the gypsies and gay people were taken away by the Germans, were arrested by the Germans, and that France resisted and didn't collaborate. Now, two events. Well, let me also tell you a story. Two stories. When I was, I hope I didn't say this the first day, but I was trying to get you interested in learning about World War II. But when I worked at a place called Tulle, T-U-L-L-E, when I was doing my research for my dissertation long ago and all that. And I'd go down, I didn't have any money, I'd go down and buy an ice cream cone for lunch. And every day, and I started talking to this guy, and I didn't speak French very well then. But I knew that there were a lot of people hung there. 99 men were hung. And because the Germans left, the Maquis, the resistors, were very active there. André Malraux, the great writer, was active in a place called Argentat, near there. And one day the Germans all left, and then everybody came out and started partying, and the Germans came back. And they hung 99 men from poles in Tulle. And one day I was there, and this guy was telling me the story about how he had hidden. He'd gone up. It's a real windy town in a valley, and he'd gone up and hidden with the, you know, you got house here, and so you got room under the house, and so he was able to hide and escape because he was 16. He would have been hung. And this woman came up, and I was eating my ice cream cone, and she ordered an ice cream cone. And so the guy suddenly said, "Well, Madame Dupont, you remember that day, don't you?" And, oh, she said, "Oh, I sure do. They hung my husband from that pole." You know, how every day you could live with that, and just, you know, talk about that as if you were discussing where you had, you know, bought something at a sale. But the next step to thinking about that is, who in France made all those things possible? Who was helping the Germans do that? And the answer is that lots of people collaborated. Lots of people got what they wanted on a platter because of the Nazi victory. And the same people who were shrieking, "Better Hitler than Blum," in 1936, got exactly what they wanted. And Marshal Pétain, who was a rabid anti-Semite, became his national revolution, was essentially aimed to do in France what Hitler had done in Germany and what other petty despots had done in other places, some not so petty, like Hitler. They got what they wanted. So how did the official line get shaken by reality? How did this happen? Second story, I have a friend who is still a lawyer in Paris, and I've known him for a long, long, long time. And he was too young to remember, but his older brother, who's dead now, remembered when the Germans came to his house in the suburbs, a place called Le Perreux-sur-Marne, took away the father, who is a Greek Jew, and of course he was taken away and was killed. I mean, he ended up in one of the camps. They don't know what happened to him. Now, the Germans didn't just come to that house by chance. The guy was denounced as a Jew by the policemen in that town. And after the war, every Saturday when this lady went to the widow went to the market, she walked by and saw this policeman directing traffic, the same guy. Nothing ever happened to him. Nothing ever happened to him. But so how did the official version get eliminated by historical reality? Histories have their histories. How did that happen? Well, there are two events that are kind of key, and they're both in what I sent around. One is the movie, The Sorrow and the Pity, which I mentioned in here before, which was described as a 2 6-pack movie in the old days when I used to show it here, because it lasts 4.5 hours. It was a documentary made for French television by Max Ophüls. It was never shown on French television till 1981. Why? Because it was a documentary in which collaborators, there's a sort of a local notable called Christian de la Mazière, who describes in his smoking in his fancy jacket in his chateau, why he fought alongside the Nazis on the Eastern Front in the Waffen-SS. And it's about collaboration and resistance, tales of true heroism, but also of repressed memory. There's a great scene in which they're walking through the school, and you know, they ask about, you know, about the teacher who disappeared, and they don't even remember about it. They don't remember it, the guys are being interviewed. They've conveniently forgotten. And so The Sorrow and the Pity, Le Chagrin et la Pitié, was never shown on French TV till 1981. I mean, it's a fantastic thing. It's too long. I should have never shown it. I started showing it twice, you know, I mean, in sections. I mean, and also it's kind of dubbed, and it's very hard to understand either in French or in English. But it's a monument. It's a monument not just because it's a driving, forceful documentary, but it's because it helped France rediscover its past. Fabulous. And talking about the role of the Communist Party. And again, I'm not a communist, but I'm telling you, the Communist Party had an enormous role in the resistance. And there's a great scene where these two peasants, most of it's about Clermont-Ferrand. The area is based on the Auvergne town of Clermont-Ferrand. There's this great scene with these two peasants out in the countryside, and they say, "Nous sommes rouges comme le vin." We're red like the wine we're drinking. It's a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous thing. And of course, there's the inevitable scene at the end where women who were called indelicately horizontal collaborators had their heads shaved and were being paraded through the town. That happened all over the place. Les tondeuses is what you call it in French. Doesn't matter what you call it in French. But in the end, there's Maurice the Chevalier. Now, your grandparents will know who Maurice Chevalier was because he kind of represented in the American imagination what France was. He was a crooner, he was a singer, who was born in Ménilmontant, which is in a proletarian edge of Paris, right near where Edith Piaf, the singer, was, whom your grandparents will have heard of also, or people way before my time. But at the end, you know, at the end of the movie, they have him, and he's wearing his little crooning suit, and he says, in English, he says, "Well, you know, there are these rumors that I was singing for the Germans, but I just want to tell you that I was only singing for the boys, that is, for the prisoners of war." And he was dealing with his own past as well. And François Mitterrand, president of France, 14 years, beginning in 1981, when he was inaugurated, the cameras follow him through the Pantheon, and he follows him by where the heart or some part of Jean Jaurès is left. But François Mitterrand, when he was dying, he came to grips with his own past. When he was dying, he too, like France, he said, there was a moment when I was not a resistor, which he became a resistor, but there was a moment that he had celebrated Vichy, and somebody had found a picture of him in a right-wing rally in 1936 or 37. Of which there were many, in Paris. And he too came to grips with his past. So this all started, the history of history, started in the 1970s. Now, the second event was a book published by my good friend Robert Paxton, who's about 10 years older than me, probably more than that. And he wrote a book called Vichy France, published in 1972. And Vichy France could not use French archives because they weren't available. There's a 50-year rule in French archives. But there is also, as we're talking about the mutinies, that, you know, the mutinies weren't available well after 50 years had passed, after the mutinies in World War I. So he used captured German documents, not French documents, because they weren't available to him. And what he did in this book was to show what Vichy and Pétain's National Revolution thought they were doing, and why many, many people collaborated. There's a more recent book by a guy called Philippe Burin that I use in the seminar on Vichy that I do from time to time, junior seminar, which explores more deeply, using these archives that are now available, the whole question of collaboration. But the point that Paxton made is that he demolished the shield argument, the argument that Pétain and the National Revolution had saved the French state, and that they were a shield. If it wasn't for Vichy, worse things would have happened. When Maurice Papon, P-A-P-O-N, went on trial, over 80 years of age, went on trial for having signed away the lives of many Jews in Bordeaux, where he worked in the prefecture, he said this, made the same argument. He said, "I was a good bureaucrat, my superiors liked me, and if it hadn't been for me, more Jews would have been shipped away to Drancy or more directly to the camps." And he was condemned, and he died a couple years ago. He was under house arrest. The most amazing part of the whole trial was he managed to escape, actually, at age 80. People drove him to the Swiss border, and they found him in a fancy Swiss restaurant and brought him back. But Papon had gone on to a very distinguished career as a bureaucrat in the 4th and 5th Republics. As did a lot of other salauds, a lot of other bastards, such as René Bousquet, who was a prefect of police. But the argument was the shield argument. If it wasn't for us, things would have been worse. But as Paxton wrote very, very memorably, that Pétain might have provided continuity for the French state, but not for the French nation. And the French nation was and is, I hope and I'm proud to say, based on liberty, fraternity, equality. And they take those off the coins, and it becomes, you know, patrie, travail, family. Family, country, work. You used to be, when I was there, you know, when I was a kid, you could see these little coins from Vichy that they transformed into centimes. And Paxton's book, Paxton once, I saw him when I was in Brussels, I saw him on a TV show, my wife and I did, and it was one of those typical French shows where they'll have, it'll be about World War I and or World War II, and they'll have somebody who remembered the war, somebody who was in the war, somebody who didn't even know what was going on, you know, and all this stuff, and they interviewed them, and some guy got up, this sort of right-wing guy, and there were protests against Paxton's presence by skinheads, and they got up and said, you know, Paxton, what could you possibly know about the war? You were only 12 years old during the war. But Paxton became, this was an important part of the history of history. And when he was introduced at the Sorbonne, he was introduced by a historian called Azema, and he said, when he introduced him, he said, Monsieur Paxton, dans un certain sens, vous êtes la conscience de la France. You know, in a certain sense, you, Paxton, are the conscience of France. So these two events are important in the emergence of what the historian Henri Rousseau called the Vichy syndrome. And then if Vichy was conveniently forgotten because of Gaullism or because of not wanting to remember the bad things that had happened, the collaborators, the eager anti-Semites, since the early 1970s, people are obsessed with Vichy. And there's all sorts of good work been done on Vichy in the whole period of resistance and collaboration. Paxton once, he estimated in that book that 2% of the French population resisted. My friend John Sweets, who did a book called Choices in Vichy France, great title, in which he looked at Clermont-Ferrand, because that was what the movie, The Sorrow and the Pity, focused on. He estimates that, depending on how you define resistance, people that refused to get off the sidewalk when a German officer passed, or people that, you know, whistled in the documentaries, the German newsreels before the movie in the theater, that something like 16 or 18% of the population resisted. It's a more charitable definition of resistance. But the fact is, and I won't talk too much more about this, but the collaboration was widespread. It was not simply an elite. The elites were more apt to collaborate earlier in the war. Later in the war, the kinds of people who joined the militia, which formed in January 1943, which was the French equivalent of the Gestapo, tended to be sort of down and out. They were the kinds of people who in Germany joined the SS, many of them. You know, in the 1920s, saw it as a form of social mobility. There's a really good film called La Combe Lucien that I haven't seen in years about somebody who between his ears there wasn't very much, and the resistance doesn't want him because he's just kind of a, you know, an idiot. He doesn't believe in anything, but the militia is very happy to have him, and it's about what happens to him in the southwest of France. During the Papon trial, which was maybe about 8 years ago or something like that, there was one time they interviewed a German officer who was still alive, and they said, "Well, look, you know, what are your memories of Papon and the militia?" He said, "Well, we got a guy. We arrested a French guy, and we rather liked him. We wouldn't turn him over to the militia because they would torture him so hideously. Of course, the Germans were capable of and did all over the place torture people hideously. No doubt about that. But the militia were genuinely bad guys." You saw this in La Combe Lucien a little bit. I mean, that restaurant scene is so crucial in La Combe Lucien. That is really the essence of that film, is in La Combe Lucien, is the restaurant scene when they're in there. So, you know, collaborators were everywhere, and, you know, at the end of the war, probably about 25,000 people were executed after very short trials or simply gunned down. Near where we live in Aldèche, there was a priest in a village not too far away from us, and he had Deya, who was a real fascist, to lunch, and after the war, they put him up against his own church and gunned him down. I have an acquaintance a long time ago, was worked in the archives in Limoges, where I spent a lot of time, and he was a young man then, and it was a refugee from Lorraine. And after the war, everybody was celebrating. He lived in a place called Saint-Léonard-de-Noblat, which is near Limoges. And they were all partying in this little village, which is a little town, really, that's 12 kilometers away from Limoges. And somebody said, "Where's the gendarme who sold people down the river?" And someone said, "He's got an aunt in Limoges." So they left all the casks of wine that were left. They marched into Limoges, went to the aunt's house, get the guy, hauled him out, put him at the beginning of this procession, joyous but also deadly serious procession, sort of an enraged charivari. And they got him back to where he had done great damage. They put him against the wall, and then he went back to partying. So there were lots of settling of scores. I mean, sometimes not everybody who had their scores settled deserved it. There were cases of people who were misidentified, or simply there were rivalries, but you know, lots of people got theirs. As for Marshal Pétain, what happened to Pétain, of course, he's put on trial. He gave the original, he was an old man. They said you can't execute an old man. He's senile, he wasn't at all. But you can't execute an old man who was the hero of Verdun, can you? So they put him house confinement on an island, and there were still people trying to get to the island, which is off the coast of Brittany, and bring back his bones to Verdun. That happened only about 10 or 12 years ago. And so France, it took a lot longer than the kind of gunning people down and the trials that went on after the war for France to come to grips with its past. Now, resistance. Did I just do something wrong? What happened? Oh, this is, all right. All right. Is that too loud? Is that all right? Dan? So okay. Resistance. What do we know about resistance? First of all, obviously it was easier to resist in the south than the north because of the topography. One of the reasons why the Germans occupied so-called Free France in November of 1942 was the fact that resistance had already started. The first active case of resistance with important consequences in Paris was at the metro stop called Barbès Rochechouart, which is now one of those places where the police, especially since Sarkozy was elected, have these rafles where they, anyone of color is immediately asked for their ID and made to stand there and be humiliated by the police. But anyway, back then somebody gunned down a German officer, and gradually acts of resistance started. To repeat what I said before, the word maquis comes from a brush, a very thick brush that's in Corsica, and in the what they call in French the garrigue, also in the sort of rocky part of the south. We have it around where we live too. But it was just a sort of a metaphor for places that you could hide, because you had to be out there hiding. And by 1944, by certainly the spring of 1944, and in many places earlier than that, the maquis ruled at least at night. During the day, they didn't. Only twice in France did they try to take on German militarized units, big units, one near Clermont-Ferrand, and the other is near the Vercors, which is near Grenoble, we're in Grenoble near the Alps. And of course, they were just wasted. They were just destroyed. In a village near us, somebody denounced people who were up in the hills, up in the Cevennes Mountains, and one day, the motorized units come and the parachutes come, and they're toast. That's the end of it. And there were a bunch of slaughters down around where we live. People don't like to talk about what happened. I wanted to interview somebody who was a resistor in our village, even though our village isn't where there were a lot of resistance going on. And I wanted to talk to him because I was writing a book about our village called I don't remember what it's called, but Mémoire de Pierre. He agreed to come over to talk about it, and then he simply never showed up. People didn't like to talk about things like that. He never did want to discuss it. But obviously more resistance was in the south than in the north. Though it's forgotten often that there was a lot of resistance in Paris, that there was Jewish resistance in Paris too. I met a guy in Australia 8 years ago who made a lot of money making cakes, then went back and got his PhD in history working with a friend of mine, Peter McPhee, and he wrote a book on the Jewish resistance published by Oxford, Jewish Resistance in Paris, a guy called Jacques Adler, who is happily still around. But the most famous cases that you all know about, of course, are these resistors who are living off the land in Auvergne or in the Cevennes Mountains or anywhere that you could hide, there would be. But they often in French cities you can see plaques saying resistors met here, to organize resistance. I mean, that's what they did. And they took big chances. Because when they, for example, blew up railroad tracks, there were so many communist resistors, and the Communist Party had a big hold on the cheminots, or railroad workers. And so a lot of when you go to railroad stations, Rouen, Lille, anywhere you go, you see huge lists, any railroad station you go to in France, huge lists of people who were killed during the war, either fighting the resistance or were shot because they were involved with sabotage. It doesn't take much to blow up a track And they did it all down the Rhone Valley constantly. There was this woman who was a big-time collaborator in the northern part of the Aldash, where the awful Xavier Vallat came from too, was Minister of Jewish Affairs, totally unrepentant. And that meant that he was shipping Jews away to be killed. That's what he was doing. And she was a collaborator. And one day she walked across the bridge and to go shopping on the other side of the Rhone, and they blew her head away. But when you did that, you knew that they were going to pay you back so much. It's when Heydrich, when I went to see where Heydrich once was assassinated near Prague. And when Heydrich was assassinated by Czech resistors, they took an entire village and killed everybody in the village. A place called Lidice. Everybody in the village. Hundreds and hundreds of people were massacred. They were capable of doing anything. But the point is that there were, in all these countries, there were people who were very, very happy to see that happen. And if you go to Budapest, when you see the shoes of all the people that were pushed, shot, or just thrown into the swirling river of the swirling water of the Danube, you know, it was Hungarians pushing the Jews there, and it was the Hungarians shipping the Jews off to Auschwitz. So there were people in every place who were happy to see these things happen. And the big lie, of course, in Germany is people didn't know. Of course people knew. They knew. And they knew in France, too. They knew, absolutely. And it fit into the xenophobia. It fit into Vichy's vision of what France would be, a vision in which the Catholic Church would have a much greater role. There were two people executed for abortion during the time, a corporatist ethic where, like Mussolini's corporatism, you'd eliminate class struggle by having everybody in vertical organizations. Everybody's happy to be French or happy to be Italian or happy to be German, and you forget the fact that your employer makes 10 times more than what you do. The kind of embrace of peasantism, the resurgence of Joan of Arc, because Joan of Arc became identified with Pétain as saving France and all of that. It's all very familiar stuff. But so they had a plan. The National Revolution was something they wanted to do. My good friend Eric Jennings, who teaches at Toronto, wrote a fantastic book called Vichy in the Tropics. And he looked at Guadeloupe, Indochina, and Madagascar. Because in those places, Vichy, you couldn't say, well, the Nazis made us do it, because there weren't any Nazis there. There were no German troops in those places. And yet there, in Vietnam, there were 27 Jews. And they desperately are trying to find these 27 Jews to send them to the death camps so far away, or to kill them themselves. So the shield argument doesn't work. They collaborated, and in the end, a lot of them got what they wanted. Now, as so far as the resistance, we've always focused on males, because the idea is you've got all these Spanish refugees from the Civil War, from Franco, and you've got all working class people, and you've got peasants, and they're all these males. And yeah, they were there, but somebody had to darn their socks, somebody had to provide them with food, somebody had to carry messages. And it's more than just one of these old movie things of the very young, attractive woman is carrying a message and charming the guards so they don't frisk her or stop her at all. But that happened. I mean, you never have to be so stupid as to have a written message, but you're carrying verbal messages in places you could hide food, such as where we lived or out near where we lived. Somebody has to take these people food. And also, the other thing is the Catholic Church, if it sounds like, this business about the Pope helping Jews is just sheer nonsense, and nobody should ever be tricked by that. The complicated role of the Catholic Church in France, there was the Archbishop of Toulouse, who was a very courageous guy, who said, don't hurt anybody, who was encouraging really resistance implicitly. And the Archbishop of Albi, which is only an hour drive, if that, from Toulouse, he was an outright collaborator. And in many places, Catholic clergy who are opinion leaders in their village, along with the school teachers, were very, very important in helping give a moral kind of stamp to acts of resistance. There's a good book on the resistance by a guy called H.R. Kedward, Rod Kedward. He's got two books, one about sort of resistance in urban areas, particularly Lyon and Montpellier, and how people kind of got together. You had to be careful about who you talked to. You're waiting for a train, the train is late because it's the war. You're kind of feeling each other out. But you better be damn careful. You're not talking to some denouncer. You're toast if you talk to the wrong person. But it's about how you can make resistance happen. It's about, for example, printing out little TypeScript things that say, do not come and hear the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra when they play in Berlin, or play in Lyon. And all you do is you get on a bus with those things, and the bus, you're in the back seat, and the bus turns the corner, you just let them go. The wind takes them. But his other book that's really good is called In Search of the Maquis, which is about precisely what I'm talking about. It's about the resistance in the South and looking at people who resisted. He has an interesting story. There's a lot of villages that were Protestant villages that suffered greatly during all the wars of religion. And a couple were noteworthy in that during, after the wars of religion, that the king had these huge mission crosses, huge crosses of conquest put up over the village, which were essentially Protestant and remained Protestant villages. Did those signs help identify the Catholic Church that had been the enemy of those Protestants in the old days with Vichy? Quite possibly. But it's what John Sweets called choices in Vichy France. Things happen that made you take a choice. Now, what were one of those things? The most important was the STO, the Service du Travail Obligatoire, which I wrote in the notes. The service, in quotes, obligatory work service. And the deal was basically that if you agreed to go along to work in a German factory, they would let some prisoners of war go and all that. It doesn't work out like that. These people were fools. Two people from our village, one was dead drunk. He thought somebody told him he was going to a party, so he got on a bus, and the next stop is the Rhineland. And of course, those people are wasted by the bombing. I mean, because the Allies are the masters of the air for the last couple years of the war, and they systematically devastate those factories. And a lot of those people in the STO that went left. But left the earth. But what the STO did is it made people take a choice. Because if you didn't show up on the 9th of February, you picked the date, 1944, you didn't go. If you're sitting in your village, they're going to come and take you. So at that point, choices in Vichy France. I'm going to go into the resistance. Big choice. You go into the resistance, you live off the land. Sometimes just a couple people, sometimes lots of people. International mix, lots of Poles were there, lots of Spaniards, but most of the people were French. And one of the interesting things is that the resistance itself did not, unlike almost everything, every big political event in France since the Revolution to 1981, did not follow traditional lines between right and left. That left-wing regions did not have a monopoly on the resistance. There was tons of resistance in Brittany. There was tons of resistance in Normandy. Eisenhower, after the war, said the French resistance was worth an entire division or two divisions. I can't remember exactly what he said. And of course, they helped prepare the way in Normandy for the invasion of June 6, 1944. So that old left-right dichotomy does not work in terms of regions. It does work in terms of what people were more likely to resist. Working people were more likely to resist. Because their unions had been broken by Vichy, because they were more apt to have supported the Popular Front. No to the France of the apéritif was the cry of the right in 1936. No to the France of drinking before lunch and all of this. No to the France of the Jew Blum. Better Hitler than Blum over and over again. So working people and peasants, like the ones who said, nous sommes rouges comme le vin, that I mentioned before, are more apt to resist. Now, why does the Communist Party have such a privileged role in the existence of the resistance? After the war, they call themselves the Party of 75,000 Martyrs. Now, that may be an exaggeration, but not by much. Because whenever there was a shooting, whenever there was a Nazi gunned down, whenever there was a railroad track blown up, carrying munitions, carrying soldiers, carrying whatever, whenever they couldn't get through, who are the ones who are first being, when they go to the mayor and says, who do you want shot? Communists would be the first to go always. And the forts around Paris, Charenton, these other places, there were communists put up against the wall all the time. They were the most likely to resist, along with other Gaullists. Jean Moulin, the prefect of the Eure-et-Loire, who was hideously tortured without revealing any secrets, was one who was sent out to try to unify the resistance. But why were the communists so effective? Well, because the Communist Party are organized into cells. We still get little notices in our mailbox saying that the Communist Party, the cell of Balazouk, where we live, all four people in the Communist Party are going to meet together and to drink illegal wine, to drink a wine called Clinton or whatever. And I was once asked to describe the fall of capitalism, and you know, I was had to say, well, it's really not falling yet. But the point is that they were already organized, and that these networks were not destroyed by the war. They existed, the comradeship. If you were a communist, you'd been a communist since the 1930s, you trusted those people, you were apt to fall in with them. There were two people, one of whom is still alive, who spent a lot of time in prison in Paris, a painter who's now, he's 95, he's a friend of mine. And he and his wife, the first vacations, they took a double bike. They drove, they pedaled all the way from Paris down to our village, which they had subsequently made their home. They joined the Communist Party in 1933 and 1935. And he was a big resistor, big time resistor. He was lucky, damn lucky, to escape with his life. He was scheduled to be executed, and he wasn't. He painted people in the prison, and I've seen his paintings. Now, the socialists weren't organized in that way, and so sometimes after the war, the communists said, aha, the socialists don't, you know, they weren't the big resistors. Well, many did individually. Leon Blum was lucky not to have been executed. He survived the war in prison. He was put on trial at a place called Lyon, right near Clermont-Ferrand. He survives the war. But there was a Catholic resistance also. I have very old friends, I mean, much older than me, who you know, went from the left-wing Catholic resistance into the Communist Party, you know, into the Socialist Party, the kind of normal trajectory of those things among militants. And they were, you know, they were resistors also. Protestants are more known for having resisted because of some very famous events. But remember, only 5% of the French population is Protestant. There's a village called Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, which is right near Ardèche, and they had a cottage industry of making fake ID for Jewish children from Lyon and Saint-Étienne who were kept in this small village and who were saved. Because of these people. And whenever the Germans would come through, which wasn't that often, they would hide the children, or the Germans would go through and said, my God, there are a lot of children. Well, these are practicing Catholics, aren't they? Well, they weren't. They were practicing Protestants. Those are the more famous cases. But lots of people resisted. But lots of people collaborated. And many other people were indifferent. That's the way it is. I want to close with the story of Orador Surgelon, because somebody who wrote this book called Martyred Village, both in French, chez Gallimard, and in English with Cal Press, was somebody who took this course with me a long time ago and was in Ezra Stiles College, Sarah Farmer. And she wrote a book. There is a village near Limoges where when the Germans were leaving, they were leaving, getting the hell out, going north. After this massacre in Tulle that I alluded to, suddenly they show up in the village and they shoot all the men and they put the men and the women and the children in the church and they kill them. They blow the church up. One woman escaped through the little window, a very thin lady escaped through the little window behind. And they destroyed the entire village. And so people who had taken the tram to the market in Limoges came back and there was nothing. Everybody was dead. Dead. And they left this village standing the way it's still there. Now there's a center of memory. One of my friends is the director of it. Sarah Farmer wrote a book about it. But the book, what is important about it is that this was the site chosen to commemorate the war. Why? Because it was virgin. No collaborators, supposedly. No resistors, supposedly. Martyred village. But what it turned out more complicated than that. It's a wonderful book. Martyred Village, Sarah Farmer. But what shows the complexity of it is what happened afterward. Is that the people in this village who were gunned down, the women and children who were killed by some Germans, but lots of them were Alsatian, who were brought directly into the German army. And so they went on trial in 1953. And there were riots in Colmar, in Strasbourg, that they should ever be put on trial. They call themselves the Malgré Nous, in spite of ourselves. And there were riots in Limoges that the penalties were so mild that some of them were let go if they had not joined voluntarily, and the others went to jail. But that's what's, and the man who ordered the massacre, a guy called Lamerding, there were various attempts to kidnap him from Germany and bring him back to France, but he died a natural death in the 1970s or 1980s. But this was the enormous ironic complexity of the whole thing, of getting into the history of history, of trying to understand what happened during those years, that some of the murderers in this case were Alsatian and therefore French until Hitler invades in 1940. So collaboration and resistance, great subjects for study, but heartbreaking, just absolutely tragic. And you know, the Nazis would be happy to do all of the stuff on their own, but the xenophobia, the anti-Semitism led to those cases of the guys going up the stairs in Paris and in other cities, and all the Papons signing lives away were French. And so France, as in other countries, is happening in Belgium too, are coming to the grips with their past. So it's been a sad pleasure to talk about that.